organized community group that began pushing for site-based management, but in more of Chicago style. And the board, you know, felt, I don't know, I guess some pressure from both flanks, and put together a task force to look at this. And the task force was very broad-based. I was on it and really had to go to every meeting and, you know, keep our views in there. But lots of community people and parents. And there, again, the push was clearly for a site-based council that looked more like the Chicago, you know, version. Would have have some teacher and non-teaching employee representation, but more parent community. And we couldn't win that battle. So what we focused on was, you know, at least getting some representation, but more focusing on the role. And what came out of that process was something called I call this putting the chemical name of the toothpaste, you know, on the package instead of a brand name. It's called the LSDMC. Lucky Strike doesn't mean, you know, no, it's called Local School Decision Making Committee. We tried to suggest, how about, you know, school site council or local school council or something, but nope, they wanted to have it really clear it was making decisions, so they put it in the mail. And actually, the way that came out was it didn't close the door to more professional involvement in school level decisions that were appropriate for the professionals to be involved, because it stopped at, they approve the school budget, they approve annual goals for the school, and they participate in the selection of principal when there's a vacancy by interviewing candidates sent to them by the superintendent and making a recommendation to who they want. That was fine. Then what we did, I mean, that was a long haul to get to that, to get to that point where we were able to sort of limited to that. Then we went to the table in, and it was in the early 90s, then we went to the table in the mid-90s, so that would have been, what, 88, one contract went from 88 through 91. I want to say it would have been the contract probably that followed, so, you know, roughly 94, 95. We got in instructional leadership teams that have a majority of teachers, some non-teaching employee representation, principal, and a representative of this LSDMC, who cannot be a teacher, must represent one of the other constituencies. So what we end up with, and that thing has a lot of power. It recommends the budget. It develops and recommends the budget to the LSDMC, but it deals with things like instructional practices, discipline, allocation of funds for supplies and, you know, instructional supplies within the school, schedules. In a team-based school, they have even more power because they actually they organize the school. They decide, you know, master schedules and credit the white terms. It starts with, they organize the teams, and the teams then slate the kids into classes within that grade level, within that team. But the ILT really, unless they let the principal just take back control, by virtue of the contract language, has really, it's a management team, is what it is. So we have a two-tiered structure for local school decision-making, and I really like it. I think this, by whatever, we backed into it through trial and error and through, you know, running up against obstacles and having to find a way to incorporate other people's interests. We end up with call it like a school site council where, sort of, it's like almost like an outside board of directors, or a board dominated by the outside directors that does the broad, you know, policy and helps pick the principal. And I'd let them fire the principal. Not fire him, but I mean, say, you're not going to be principal of our school anymore. We propose that a couple times along the way. But then we have a more of an internal leadership team that is majority of professionals and that makes professional decisions on the professional issues. I actually think we found a balance that, you know, gets everybody at the table, and it seems to work pretty well. And it takes maintenance, like any other structure. It takes ongoing training, and there hasn't been enough of it, and it doesn't work well in every school. But I think it's a good structure.
What were some of the critics on that? Criticisms?
Well, I guess one of the reasons why I think it's a good structure is because it has been pretty durable It doesn't generate a lot of flack. I think people, you know, the LSDMC is much more, just like the ILT, it's much more either structure works well when there's activists in the community that help organize people to serve on it, you know, and it just ends up being a rubber stamp for the principle when you don't have an organized community base to feed people into it. And the same is true with the ILT inside the building. If you don't have an active union chapter, if your union members aren't organized at the school, then they won't have a strong representative body either. Just because you get people's names on there, you know, the principal may just run it if there's not a constituency that's active and that those representatives are reporting back to. So you have to take advantage of the structure. But where they're functioning, you know, they function to various degrees in all buildings. I think there's been some balance struck, and you don't get a lot of flack from any direction.
Hmm. Cool. By this time, AFT has definitely taken an eye on you, and they asked you to run for council in about 92.
Well, they didn't actually ask me. I put my name in three times before I got elected. I guess I first put my name in, I got elected in 92, so it'll be 88, I guess, was my first shot at seeking the Progressive Caucus nomination. My first convention was all the way back in 78, I believe, in Boston. Is that Boston?
Mm-hmm.
When the PL took over the stage.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And Rennie had to beat some of them down.
Mm-hmm. That must have been a good first convention.
It was great. Wow, it was wild. And I went right for the International Affairs Committee, and I was pushing some Irish issues at the time, and found Tony McCann, who became one of my chief collaborators. He's retiring. He's just retiring this year. He's longtime president of the Shenandoah local outside of Albany. So my cousin works in the district now, stuff too. So his family ties, but you know, it's Kathleen's father. Met him in that International Affairs Committee, and came along. Whole family friendship developed out of it. In fact, at 78, but also gravitated initially to the United Action Caucus because they seemed to be, I don't know, just because they were the, I didn't know much about AFT politics. I didn't know anything about AFT politics. I certainly had a lot of admiration for Al, but didn't know a lot of the, you know, issues that get debated at conventions. And this seemed like the more rebellious group, so I naturally gravitated to them. I was actually also a fan at that point of the secret ballot, and later there was a secret ballot caucus that was independent of the United Action Caucus. I was involved in that for a while. I think it was maybe only two conventions only that I stayed in the United Action Caucus, because here's what happened. I noticed, of course, that Shanker was kind of red-baiting them, either explicitly or a little less than a little more subtly, but probably not very subtly, or other people that were close to him were doing so. And of course, I was skeptical of that. I mean, that was a tactic that I associated with McCarthyism, and I thought that was terrible. And I spent a lot of time in these United Action Caucus meetings where we would be debating what our position should be on every resolution before the convention. So this took hours and hours of deliberation and contention, and people with, you know, a lot of debating skills and parliamentary skills and a lot of maneuvering within a room of that maybe had, at its peak, at least in my time at conventions, maybe 40 people, you know, in a room. That would be really the peak. And, you know, of course, I thought this was dumb because we ought to be, if you wanted to organize opposition or you wanted to organize around an issue, pick one, two, or at the most three issues and go out and organize. We should have been out in the parties that all the delegations are having and organizing around some issues instead of sitting here for hours in the evening debating the fine points of, you know, every resolution before the convention. So I thought they were, really clear they were tactically, you know, not very together. But what really drove me out of there was getting up one morning and going to the convention floor, and they had, you know, they used to have troops in those days, at least, to pass out a newsletter and stuff. And so they're passing out a packet from the United Action Caucus with the newsletter and a sheet of where we stand on different constitutional amendments. And in with the packet, and I think it was even wrapped around it, I think it was like the first thing you saw, was a pamphlet entitled "The Soviet Union, an Ally for Peace." Well, you know what? We didn't vote on that.
Mm-hmm.
We did not debate that. We did not decide collectively that we were going to include that in the packet. But of course, that becomes the real label, the real, you know, positioning, the real, you know, here's who we are. I said, okay, well, Al was right on that one. I mean, I was beginning to. I mean, it was clear that there were. You know, it was very clear just being in the room that there were various left factions, including CP people. I can you know detect the stuff, but I mean, I didn't. I still wasn't sure there was a total front until
they actually had a wrapped in paper bag for you.
So, end of that story. And I think after that, as I did even once I got out of that, took part in the secret ballot, you know, committee, which was not a caucus that ran candidates, but just agitated on the issue. And later, I once you're running a local and you're electing delegates and you're paying their way, and you know you do kind of want to know. You think the members have a right to know. I came around on that position too. Mm-hmm. That you really do. These are not individual voters. These are representatives of other people. So yeah, then I joined the Progressive Caucus. I can't remember exactly when, but it was early '80s. I mean, it would have been pretty early in the '80s. So in '88, put my name in. You know,
right?
Again in '90, and finally made it in '92.
What was kind of the environment for the AFT conventions during the '80s? I mean, you had Reagan in LA.
Yeah, in fact, well, actually, I had my one-year-old son with me at that convention. I wasn't going to go, as a matter of fact, and because it was, I was already, unfortunately, already divorced. So I had a month, I had my son for a month, and I wasn't going to go. I mean, I was going to take a pass, and new father and all that. Then two things happened. They actually asked me to do a workshop, I think probably on that Bargaining for Better Schools campaign. And Al decided to invite Reagan, which was very controversial, of course. So I figured there were going to be some action around that I didn't want to miss. So I literally had, went to the convention, got to, the local had a list of babysitters, got a babysitter, didn't speak any English. It didn't matter because my son didn't either. But he did walk. He was like one of these kids who really wanted to walk before he cared about talking. My daughter was just the opposite. So I remember them in the hotel, you know, I'd come back to the hotel room and she had moved the furniture over to block the windows, make sure he couldn't move her way by. And she was chasing them around and he was happy as a clam, you know. But I took him to the floor also sometimes in a little backpack and we did walk out on Reagan together. You know, with him and his little backpack, just couldn't do otherwise. And the other thing in the '80s, of course, was again professional issues coming to the fore in the mid to late '80s, and I was really, you know, very very on board with Al, including his watershed, you know, '85 speech. That was right after the Carnegie Report. It was all fitting together for me. It was like this was between what the AFT had to say and this Carnegie Report. We felt we had a blueprint for creating a profession out of a group of, you know, professionally trained employees of a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. But it was also time big debates on Central America. And I missed the Vietnam debates in the AFT, but seemed like somewhat of a replay in terms of the forces at work. And I was very, and despite at that point being in the Progressive Caucus and supporting our leadership in general and, you know, and on nearly all other issues, I was not. I was very much against aid to the Contras, and didn't think we ought to be supporting the butchers that were running El Salvador at the time, and that put me at odds with at least the foreign policy apparatus of the AFT at that time. And I did a debate. I had, you know, a lot of good, respectful debates with some friends in both staff and elected positions on those issues, and you know, we just didn't always agree.
Was the usual argument, we're trying to defend free trade unionisms against the left-leaning parties?
That these guerrilla movements were really, you know, communist-led, and they were, you know, they were going to impose totalitarianism if they won, and there wouldn't be free trade unions, blah, blah, blah. I mean, my whole view of that is that the U.S. made a lot of mistakes in the 50s, through the '80s, and a big chunk of the labor movement went along for the ride, because they saw every single struggle as nothing but, or overwhelmingly as, an extension of the U.S.-Soviet struggle. And they failed to take into account that there were many cases where people were really rebelling against either colonialism, like in Portuguese Africa, or local oppressive elites, or whatever, trying to make their own destiny. And yep, they maybe some factions may be taking aid from wherever they can get it, but that didn't mean the whole thing boiled down to us versus them. And it also didn't mean that some of these local elites were worthy of our support. And that there may even be some cases where there is nobody worth that you'd really want to get behind and invest blood, treasure, and your national reputation or the labor movement's reputation in. So it wasn't that I necessarily thought every guerrilla movement, well, I probably did once upon a time, but not by the 80s, was a good guerrilla movement, and that, yes, some of them no doubt were. I think that we made huge blunders in places like Nicaragua, where you could have probably co-opted, you know, the Sandinistas, and places like El Salvador, where you had a whole bunch of elements of this FMLN that you could have worked with some factions of and tried to gain influence for the long haul, but to support the people who were, you know, butchering nuns and assassinating archbishops, I couldn't go there, you know. And I think there was also, but on the other hand, the other thing that, as far as how this played out in AFT, was that the left was a total disaster on this in the 80s. They were just so incredibly inept and so bumbling.
Is it still run by the United Action, the left?
No. By this point, what you're getting, by this point, the United Action is just, you know, barely alive and weren't a significant force. What you were more getting was, and you had a few people who were various kinds of left politics that were actually very embedded in a local and played a role in a local. More often, you had people getting themselves elected delegates who were really solidarity activists, you know, who were really CISPES or some other, you know, groups that they were part of, which is fine, going in and getting themselves elected delegates so they could come to the convention and raise these issues, which is also fine. You just wish they would do a little homework before they started, you know, improvising. There wasn't any real political cohesion among them, and they just bumbled. And it was, you know, I would sometimes try to give tactical advice, but it was mostly hopeless. So I couldn't do much about it. But I do remember one moment when I was, there was no we in an organized sense, but I was helping out whatever group was really organizing an event during the lunch break. Now I'm going to forget. It was either somebody from the Sandinista teachers. No, it was somebody from the El Salvador teachers union, I think. I'm not sure. It was either Nicaragua or El Salvador. And I had volunteered like an idiot to get up to the mic, you know, try to get up to the mic before lunch break and with the flyers were going around and to announce it, you know, to kind of urge people to go. Well, Al, right before he breaks for lunch, he's up at the mic, up at the podium, waving one of these flyers around and flat out says, these people, the people who are, something to the effect that, you know, the people, this union, you know, these people are, this is a communist union, or it's a communist-led union, or something to that effect. So, okay. Here I got to test my moral backbone here. But I did make the announcement. But, you know, that was an honest disagreement with people who I otherwise had, you know, very, very many more areas of agreement with, and I think it was sort of the, you know, I don't think there was total right or wrong on either side. I mean, El Salvador looks like a place where the right won. I mean, both countries do, really, and I don't know that that's good for the working class or teachers or education, public education, or anything else. I'm not sure. I still don't think we were on the right side. And then there's places like, now I'm speaking about more broadly U.S. foreign policy, Angola, you know. Fuck. I mean, we got some serious answering to do for having supported two different, you know, guerrilla movements against the main guerrilla movement that was, you know, struggling for independence because we thought the main guerrilla movement was too left. And how many years of civil war resulted from that, and how many people had to die, and how many, you know, how much that destroyed the infrastructure so that health you know, a lot of other people died of diseases they shouldn't have died of and are still ignorant and illiterate because they weren't making schools. I mean, there's no justification for that. I believe history will be very harsh on those who supported the Holden Robertos and the, what's the other asshole's names? Savimbi, General Savimbi, yeah. So I think a lot of mistakes were made, and I think sometimes labor went too readily along for the ride.
But when you joined the Foreign Policy and International Committee as a representative of CFT, when you came back to your local, were there questions about why are you involving yourself with international work when you'd be talking about our collective bargaining or as teachers and education?
Oh, I don't think there were any more questions about that than any other committee I went left town to serve on. I mean, it was more just, why is he out of town again? Which was, you know, I straddled the limit of what was either responsible in terms of getting my work done home or politically, you know, viable to do. But I really believe the national union is important. I believe it's important to the, and I think that becomes increasingly clear as time goes on, you know, in terms of the federal role in education just gets bigger. It's almost not even debatable now. Although some people, you still have to explain why the media is important. But I do think the national union plays a terribly important role in supporting and always has in terms of supporting locals and supporting state federations, but also in helping to try to set a tone nationally that creates some covering fire for us to, you know, try to win friends and influence people at the local and state level. If the national union stands for the right things, and of course this is why Al and Sandy's leadership was so crucial on educational issues, did us so much good at the local level, was we had something to point to that, you know, this is what we're for, this is how we are trying to improve things. So anyway, I didn't have any problem in my own mind justifying it, but it was, you know, sometimes, challenging to try and explain. But I actually don't think the international affairs thing was any more or less, especially to the extent that you were really doing work to, like we brought folks, after I went and did two stints as an election observer in Chile, we had the opportunity to host some leaders of the Chilean Teachers Union in Cincinnati. People loved that. You know, people were really could, you know, really could relate to that. And we were part of, in some small way at least, trying to get rid of their dictatorship.
So you were down in Chile during the new Placide?
Yep. And then again for the first presidential election after.
What was that first trip down to Chile like?
Well, see, they knew I was crazy and adventurous, so they sent me to the most right-wing region. It was Region 9. It was headquartered, based in Temuco, so it's like south central, or central central really, because then there's that whole archipelago down there. And it was, the town of Temuco was okay, and they voted no, but the region voted yes. It was the only region that voted yes. So we went out into the region too, in terms of small. It was Araucania country and places where they had the big estates that not the Andes, but the Miristas, you know, tried to stage takeovers at. In some cases, it was very, you know, patrons that ruled with an iron fist and bust their workers into the town to vote, and everybody believed that the patron would know how you voted. And even in the town, you know, that was a big, that we spent a lot of time talking to people about the process, and they really won't know how you vote.
You're trying to teach them democracy at that moment of practicing democracy.
Well, yes and no, because they actually could teach us a lot. I mean, they had a long history. I mean, that was what stood them in good stead when they finally got the opportunity, because they had a long history and a well-established way of voting, you know, and one where the votes are counted right here, right now, so they don't get lost on the way down to the Board of Elections or whatever. You know, they vote, they have observers from every party. It was a very good process.
We need that.
The observers from every party, and that precinct. A lot of teachers were election judges, you know, election observers, not party observers, but they were the administrative, you know, people running the election. Because you find in the small towns, you find somebody educated to do that, you know, and teachers are disproportionately represented. But then they counted the votes right there in front of all the observers from the various parties. So every party representative is calling or faxing results, you know, to a city or district or regional office, and they're all going to Santiago. So there's like five parallel counts going on, you know, nationally besides the official count. So it's very hard to, it was been very hard to manipulate that process and get away with it, I think. So that was pretty cool. But the thing that was weird is the guys in the polling places with big automatic weapons. And but the folks in the town told us that those weren't the guys to be scared of. It was the guys with the big knives strapped on their hips that you should worry about. Because they were the riot control carbonary or, you know, detachment. I didn't even want to add, I didn't want to ask what the knives were for, you know, how they wielded them. But that was a great, that was a great opportunity. I was supposed to go observe the first democratic elections in South Africa. And that's the case where I had to prioritize local work because we didn't have a contract. You know, it was one of those contracts that we were taking as long as we had to take to get a good contract. And it was, you know, 3 months into the what should have been the new contract, and we didn't have settlement. And there was no way I could go away for a couple of weeks.
But you went to Chile. It was interesting. So you're finally elected the vice president for the AFT in 1992. What was the board? How large was the board then? About 30?
Wasn't that much. It's like grown a little bit since then.
Yeah.
Can't have grown by more than 4 or 5 since then, I think.
Probably. Yeah. What was your first meetings like?
I don't know. I don't remember.
It was a blur.
Yeah. Been to too many of them by now. Well, I remember thinking that, you know, the general, the perception from the outside, I don't mean just being from the opposition, but from the outside, is that things are really controlled, you know, because in fact, you know, conventions, by the time you got to convention, there was political support generated and organized for at least the major initiatives and resolutions. And I was somewhat, a little bit surprised and pleased by how much healthy debate there was at the council meetings, at least on some things. And of course, anytime you have Alfani in the room, you're going to have lively debate, so that always helps. But no, it was, you know, I felt like it was a great opportunity, and you know, yeah, I've never felt you didn't have a real opportunity to debate stuff. And of course, the thing when you learn when you got closer into Al is, oh, you know, he can be intimidating, not in a mean sense, but just in an intellectual sense. And actually, I'll go further and say that he was the only person since my grandfather died that I was ever really in awe of. And I would get, I mean, I've been a mouthy, you know, debater since I was, you know, very young, you know, doing stuff in high school and stuff, or junior high. I would get tongue-tied around him and not be able to clearly articulate, you know, whatever idea was somewhere in my head. It took a long time, you know, to get more comfortable. I don't know, probably didn't have enough chance to just hang out informally like other people did. But eventually I realized he liked to argue. He wanted you to argue with him. He didn't probably have much respect for you if you didn't argue back. So that was a revelation. I wish I had discovered that, you know, earlier on. So, no, it's been a great opportunity, great experience to be on the council. And,
you know, they're asking you on the executive committee?
Yeah, that was, of course, I was happy to be asked, but that was something you don't campaign for, at least I certainly didn't. That was in New Orleans, so whenever the hell that, whatever that year was, last time we were in New Orleans. That was when actually Sandy, that was kind of, yeah, that was a big year for me, because that was when Sandy asked me to be on the executive committee and chair the PPC.
Which PPC?
The K-12.
Yeah.
Now pre-K-12. So that was actually
New Orleans was big for him.
Step in responsibility.
That was like 1998.
That right? Yeah, that's. I don't remember.
So what's the difference between the council and the committee?
In some ways, it is just a committee of the council that has certain assignments, which is to deal with staffing issues, personnel issues. Dues. Well, no, that's not true. Dues goes through the Constitutional Amendments Committee. But we talk about it, obviously. So, I mean, in some ways it has its turf in terms of committees that have to you know, formulate recommendations for the council or the convention. And then in some ways it does talk about overall, you know, big picture stuff, where recently it's a lot been AFL-CIO, other times it's been, you know, NEA relations or merger. We were the merger. That meant I was on the merger bargaining team for the second round that didn't really go anywhere, but that was still interesting. So yeah, to some extent we have, you know, we've been having the last few years retreats. Andy started having or at least once a year, maybe even twice a year, a retreat, meaning at least a dinner and a whole day where it isn't just the routine, or it's not at all the routine business. So we get a chance to talk about more general direction. So that's been a great opportunity too.
Do you want to talk about the PPCs? I mean, how are they formed? What's the purpose? Has it been successful?
I think it's been very successful. I mean, the purpose was a combination of some political pressures. I think we had, you know, during the time that I was trying to get on the council, you had a lot of pressures of both sort of up-and-coming leaders, divisions. When I say they weren't formal divisions then, but people from different non-teaching constituencies wanting more representation, trying to balance that with size of local, with geography and region, you know, with gender, with ethnic, you know, representation, blah, blah, blah. So part of it was seen as a chance to get more people involved at the national level, more people understanding and contributing to the policies of the national union. So that in itself was a really good reason. Part of it was because other constituency people on the council, that were on the council, got bored of teacher stuff all the time and felt like their issues didn't get enough attention or deliberation. And also the hope to grow in those other constituencies and wanting to be able to sell as part of the sell that there is a leadership body in the AFT devoted to your, you know, constituencies and its issues. Those are the main things. So I think it was a good idea. It was right, and the timing was right. It was an idea whose time had come. And I think it's done. I think it has done pretty much all those things. Certainly given a lot more. Some might say like the pre-K-12 is, some people think it's too big. And it becomes, I think the risk, the danger is that it becomes, instead of a leadership body, it becomes, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for? It just becomes a focus group, you know, instead of a leadership body. And so you may want to be, you may want to think about being a little bit more selective. And the point is not so much to make sure every single state's represented, every single region, every single this, that, and the other, but to really get, do a little bit of that, but get a group of people who really will grapple with the issues and try to lead us in some direction. But overall, I think those have worked very well, and I enjoyed chairing. Got a little frustrated in the last couple years, primarily around NCLB. I just didn't think we were where we needed to be on NCLB, and when we formally, by resolution, got to where I thought we ought to be, I saw no implementation. I saw a lot of foot dragging on implementing that new policy, and I frankly got to the point where I didn't want to front for it anymore. Mm-hmm. That my constituent, my state, people feel very strongly about it. I think teachers in other states do too. I think the members of the PPC did, but they weren't. I don't think we were seeing action by the organization to reflect the views of the PPC or, in fact, what the convention had adopted. It was just like, I felt like I was out there perhaps a bit being taken for granted or asked to front for stuff that I didn't really have a real say. It's one thing to, you know, it's one thing, I think I'm pretty good at being a soldier as well as a leader, in other words, or at least a part of a team. So if I'm in the room where the issue's being debated, you know, even if it's a behind-the-scenes kind of room, and I lose the argument and we go forward with a somewhat different policy than what or tactical approach or plan of battle than I was advocating, I can deal with that. But when I feel like I'm not even in the room where the decisions are really being made, and then I'm supposed to get up and chair a meeting and put a happy face on it, I find that to be an untenable position. So that's what it got to, I guess, you know, by last summer. So that's why I resigned that position. But hopefully it's not some big split or some big feud. I'm not really mad at anybody, you know, in particular. I think it was somewhat of a bureaucratic disconnect, too many departments operating in silos. I think there was some foot dragging, more in the staff than at the elected leader level. But that's just speculation. I don't really know why it wasn't moving, but it wasn't moving. But that's not, like I said, it's not a big split or feud. It's something I think we'll pass and we'll get through it. And
it seems like we're moving now. A blog on NCLCD. Yeah. There's a more
still too slow. I mean, not too slow. I mean, actually, again, the policies we're now formulating, or the proposals we're now formulating for the reauthorization, I think, are sound. You know, I think the resolution we passed the last convention was just about where we needed to be. I just think there isn't enough oomph behind this. In other words, there's not enough resources being put into it. We did one flight of ads, and then we were planning another, and then that got dropped. So I think there's not enough real oomph, like it's a real campaign.
Right.
So I won't say we're not moving in the right direction. It just seems like, you know, a little plotting rather than really driving for something.
It's past three. Do you want to do a wrap up?
I'm going to have to run out to a meeting, and I got to take care of a couple of things first.
Then this is a good segue to say it's kind of reflective time. Why don't you reflect on us, where the AFT has been, where it's going, what is the AFT today?
Well, if we pick that up next time.
Absolutely.
Yep. That sounds like something I want to reflect on a little bit.
Okay.
Rather than just rush through it.